You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk with the ombudsman from NPR about public accountability at a time of deep distrust of the media. First, it's well understood that traffic accidents, tickets, or living in a busier area can drive up the price of your auto insurance. But a new study from ProPublica finds that minority neighborhoods are paying more, even when the risk factors are equal or less than they are in majority white neighborhoods. Jeff Larson joins us now. He's a reporter and a news applications developer with ProPublica and one of the authors of that report. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, how large were the disparities you found between auto insurance rates in white and minority neighborhoods?
In Illinois, which is one of the four states that we looked at, 33 out of 34 companies were charging more than 10%. There were a handful of companies that were charging more than 30% in premiums when we compared minority neighborhoods with white neighborhoods.
And the study looks deeply into the numbers, the data that you did have, but you also spoke with a lot of people. Can you tell us about some of the challenges that people said they were facing because they may have been one of these people who ended up having to pay more, sometimes quite a bit more, for their car insurance?
Yeah, one of the main characters in our story, Otis Nash, he has two jobs and he works 6 days a week. And in order to get to those jobs, he obviously needs a car. And his car insurance was making it so that it was such a struggle just to even have enough money to pay rent.
And when you talked to him about some of these disparities that you found, and also you found a corollary to him in a white neighborhood, what did people tell you about how they felt about what these rates were like?
Some people told us that, you know, just that they were sort of actually on both sides, they were sort of aghast at what was happening. To both the African American people that we talked to and the white people in our story, did not quite understand how this could possibly be happening. It doesn't seem particularly fair, especially when we were looking at the underlying risk in comparable neighborhoods. And seeing that they didn't add up in terms of the increased premiums charged by car insurance companies in minority neighborhoods.
Right. Can you walk us through how you came up with these numbers?
Yeah. So we worked with two private insurance company intelligence outfits, one who gave us the quoted premiums by zip code in the four states, and one who provided us with access to the underlying filings in each state. And then what we did is we asked all 50 states for whether or not they collect the insurance commissioners in all 50 states and for whether or not they collect the underlying risk data, so how risky it is in each individual zip code in their state. Only four of them actually collected that data, Illinois being one of them. And when we compared the premiums that we had bought to the risk data, we saw this gigantic sort of disparity, especially in Illinois.
And when you heard back from some of the insurance companies involved, when you shared your findings, they said, yeah, but we don't collect data on race. So how can you say that this is something that could somehow be based in a deliberate racial disparity? What's your answer to that?
Well, we can't really know because of two things. One thing is we don't know how they calculate these, how they calculate premiums, you know, risk based on individual zip codes, how they calculate one zip code is more dangerous than another zip code. Every company does it a little bit differently, I would assume. We also don't know what their underlying risk is. All we can say is, you know, what each individual company's risk is. We were able to get information about how risky it is across all insurance companies, so across all insurance payouts. So there is a slim chance that perhaps one company's risk is wildly different than the global average, although that's slim in terms of statistics. Even if they're not collecting data, if they're not making decisions on risk, which I'll give them that. I mean, based on race, which I'll give them that. There still is such a disparity that they're taking something else into account that is predictive of race of a zip code. Because we see such huge disparities, people live in similarly risky areas should, in theory, in insurance theory, get similarly risky prices. Similar prices. That they're not is something that the insurance companies haven't yet answered why this is happening.
And you're right about how the data was hard to get. There wasn't the easy transparency there that you could drill down all the way when you were looking at some of these factors. Why is that data difficult to get a hold on?
Well, the insurance companies have fought tooth and nail to allow this data to get out. In fact, interesting sort of historical bit of trivia is that they got an antitrust exemption so they can share it amongst themselves. But most states don't actually collect it, require insurance companies to report it to the state, right? So the insurance commissioner charged with oversight over the insurance industry to make sure that they're not doing disparate pricing. Most states don't collect them, don't collect that internal loss data. So we didn't know. There's no list of who does and does not collect it. We asked all 50 states. In Wisconsin, they said they did not collect it. And across the country, we only got 4 insurance commissioners that could provide it to us. And, that was a month-long process to even get that amount of data.
We're talking with Jeff Larson right now from ProPublica, talking about a report that he co-authored that finds residents of minority neighborhoods pay more for car insurance than predominantly white neighborhoods with the same risk levels. And your article raises the question about whether you're reporting about what you're reporting about is redlining or discriminatory business practices that hurt people of color. Can you give us a bit of background on that practice of redlining and also how it's being regulated now?
Well, traditionally, the way we think about redlining is refusal of service. So redlining as a term sort of, is defined as refusing to sell insurance to African-American neighborhoods, for example. And it starts, it's had a troubled history in real estate and in property insurance. Not so much in car insurance until our article. This is a different form of redlining than what's popularly understood. I would say it's disparate pricing. What we're seeing is this difference in premiums that doesn't seem to follow the underlying risk in a neighborhood.
So where do you go from here to find more data to find out whether this is in fact what you're looking at?
Well, the insurance industry, the day after our story published, did write up a rebuttal and said, we do have internal data that shows that this is not the case, and that we do our jobs and all of it, and we're very careful when it comes to these sorts of problems, to which we would sort of just say back, hey, if you want to send us your internal data, we'll take another look at it. But as it stands now, it does not look like you're pricing to risk. And in at least 2 states, the vast majority of the companies that we looked at, the top companies in the state, don't seem to be following that insurance tenet that, riskier areas pay more because we expect to pay out to protect them.
And as we wrap up, Jeff, based on the time you spent researching this, what do you think would have to change about the way companies insure people to close that racial gap?
I think California does really well in terms of regulation. I think California was, while we did find disparities, the disparities weren't as stark, and companies in California were by and large following this idea of increased risk, increased premium. And I think that has to do with the fact that California has fairly, very highly regulated laws. The insurance, the reporting requirements, the way that insurers are required to price at least a little bit to the overall risk is one solution for this problem.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Jeff Larson, reporter and news applications developer at ProPublica, joining us there to talk about a report that he co-authored that finds residents of minority neighborhoods pay more for car insurance than predominantly white neighborhoods with the same risk. Recent polls show that Americans' trust in mass media has sunk to an all-time low. And at a time where we're seeing a proliferation of fake news, many people feel distrustful of what they read and hear in the media. At the same time, social media is driving a tendency to choose media that resonate with our own viewpoint, meaning it gets easier and easier to live inside our own media bubble and not be challenged by opposing viewpoints. This could lead us to ask, how does public media uphold its commitment to fairness and accuracy? To help answer these questions, Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson recently sat down with NPR Ombudsman Elizabeth Jensen.
So you are the NPR Ombudsman. What is an ombudsman exactly?
Well, it's sort of a unique role in journalism. Some organizations, the very few organizations that that do still have an ombudsman, some of them call it a public editor. So the role is basically a liaison, the representative of the public in the newsroom. So I'm the liaison between the public and NPR's journalists. I try to surface the concerns that listeners have with the newsroom, and then conversely, I try to explain to the listeners sort of the decision-making that goes on in the newsroom, sort of why they're hearing what they're hearing.
And so it sounds like this used to be a more common role that was present in media organizations. Why do you think there are fewer today?
It was indeed more common probably 10, 15 years ago. A number of organizations have gotten rid of the ombudsman largely for cost. But there's also the role of social media. So there are some editors or publishers who feel that the social media can bring to light concerns that listeners have or readers or viewers have with journalism, that that these issues will bubble up on social media and that you don't need an intermediary, if you will, to really answer those listener concerns and to bring them forward in the newsroom. What we who are still in this business would argue is that an ombudsman plays a different role than social media. Yes, we are bringing those concerns to the attention of the newsroom, but it's also about being charged to be able to comment on it. So I report to the CEO of NPR. I don't report to the newsroom. I also don't have management authority in the newsroom, so I can't order up a change. But I have a column, and what I can do is I can write about issues and thoughtfully consider them, if you will, and sort of bringing that public platform to these listener concerns the hope is that the sort of they will get a wider hearing and, perhaps changes will be made if changes are warranted.
Well, in speaking of the column that you wrote, you recently wrote an article saying that NPR is increasingly challenged by misinformation. Where do you see that misinformation coming from?
Right. We're in an interesting journalism time right now. The country itself is fairly polarized. That's not just journalism. People are sort of fighting hard for their positions, and what we seem to be finding is that in live interviews, there are a lot of facts that are sort of being misrepresented, if you will. This is happening on both sides. People have talking points. They're trying to argue for their position on legislation, important issues of the day. These sometimes get condensed down into talking points, and not all those talking points are necessarily accurate. The challenge for NPR in particular is when you have a live interview and somebody throws out a statistic, the host, NPR's hosts are terrific. You can't always have every single statistic at your fingertips, and you have to be listening very critically. And you're doing a 5-minute interview and someone suddenly throws a statistic at you that may or may not be accurate. You don't necessarily have the resources immediately at hand to, if you don't know it off the top of your head, to check it out. The challenge then becomes to not let that information go uncorrected. And so how does NPR deal with that?
So, and so what are the options that you see as the ombudsman, as someone who's advocating for providing the best service and information to the listeners? What are some of the options for making those corrections? Is it in the moment? Is it later? If it's later, where is it? And how easy is it to find?
Right. In the moment is definitely the best. So if somebody hears something on air and that a statement that an interviewee is making, the best option, of course, is to stop them respectfully right there and say, well, but those aren't the statistics we have, or to push back, if you will. But again, that doesn't always happen because people don't necessarily know all of the statistics in the moment. So NPR has tried to deal with it in a couple ways. So you can do a correction on air later. The challenge with that is that, for the most part, NPR listeners don't listen to 2 hours of a show. They'll listen while they're in their car and their commute. So what is that, 11 minutes, 20 minutes?
So they may hear the original, but not the correction.
They wouldn't hear the correction, right. You can do a correction online, but again, there's not necessarily that much crossover between sort of the listeners who hear something on air and the NPR.org readers. One way that NPR has been handling it that I think is at least certainly one way to partly solve the problem is NPR, of course, broadcasts across many time zones, and some of the programs are repeat. Some of the interviews are repeated. Even many stations air the morning edition, mm-hmm. say from 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. So if we do an interview and the editors realize in the moment or after the fact that there was a mistake, they're now going back in and editing it and adding in a fact check for the subsequent rebroadcast of that interview.
So at least maybe the Pacific time zone listeners get the correction.
Right, or the person who heard it at 7 a.m. versus 5 a.m. will at least get the accurate information. So I think NPR is really sort of working very hard to try and meet this challenge. Mm-hmm. I just don't think there's an obvious answer to this issue. So the one final answer, of course, would be to pre-tape all interviews. That's not optimal. You want to get people in the moment. The news is moving very fast mm-hmm. these days, and you want to be on top of it. You don't want to wait a day, which sometimes happens if you have to pre-tape an interview.
Right. We're talking with NPR Ombudsman Elizabeth Jensen about her role as a listener advocate and the opportunities and challenges facing journalism today. Well, as we've talked about, there are a lot of ways that people consume media now, listening to the radio, TV, but all the social media ways that the news is disseminated. And it's become easier, I think, for news consumers to live in their own media bubbles to the point where people seem to be working off of completely different sets of facts, whatever facts agree with their position. What is the role of NPR and other public media in that current landscape?
Mm-hmm. I think it is a challenge for NPR. NPR was founded on the premise that there would be respectful conversation with people who hold multitude of perspectives, so covering the gamut. Increasingly, as you say, we see people gravitating towards media that really fits their own bubble and their own landscape, and they're not necessarily interested in hearing the perspective of someone who is coming from a different place than they are. I think that there's still a role for the NPRs of the world. I think that NPR needs to be very clear about its mission and its framing and to say, this is what we do. We hear from everyone. Sometimes listeners, they'll only hear a single interview and they'll say, oh, you're biased against, my position. If you wait sort of an hour, you'll hear another interview with a different perspective. So I think NPR perhaps could be better at communicating that to the public that, you're hearing from Congressman X right now, but in an hour you're going to hear from Congresswoman Y and who's going to have an opposite point of view. So I think there are some things that some tweaks that can be made to the model to make it very clear that NPR hears from from all perspectives. But I do think that there is a role, but I think you have to fight and advocate for your role, if you will.
Well, and also there is this feeling of very deep skepticism about the media, even attacks on the media,
right,
both from political leaders and from people who are following their lead.
Right.
As the ombudsman at NPR, are you sensing a shift in the trust that people have in the media?
I think so, absolutely. The number of complaints of bias against the programming are certainly rising, but they're coming from both sides. So I don't think that's necessarily an adequate answer to say, oh, we hear from equal numbers of people from both sides, so we must be doing something right. But that is, they are wide-ranging, the concerns. One of the things I think NPR has done very well in the past year, it really started in the summer, was putting an emphasis on fact-checking. And they rolled this out for the presidential debates. They were fact-checking the debates in real time. And it's not just fact-checking, it's also annotating, which I think is just very helpful. So
providing some context.
Right, providing context so the listeners really know sort of, you know, where does this fact or this statement fit in the landscape. The fact may be true, but the context is wrong, or vice versa, or the fact may just be completely wrong. So I think fact-checking has become very, very important in this era of distrust. And so I think NPR is not alone in sort of emphasizing fact-checking. Others have been increasingly doing that as well. But I think that's it's definitely a public service that NPR has been able to provide. And I think it goes a long way to sort of addressing some of these concerns and mistrust of the media.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Elizabeth Jensen, the ombudsman from NPR, talking about how NPR upholds public trust in an age of increasing misinformation. Donald Trump has been in office 84 days today and has reversed his position on several key policies within that time span. This week alone has been especially eventful. Yesterday, he reversed his stance on more than half a dozen campaign promises. For example, after speaking positively about Russian President Vladimir Putin on the campaign trail, Trump this week described relations between the two countries as at an all-time low.
It would be wonderful if NATO and our country could get along with Russia. Right now, we're not getting along with Russia at all. We may be at an all-time low in terms of relationship with Russia. This is built for a long period of time.
Meanwhile, President Trump, after hosting Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago last week, said he will no longer accuse China of currency manipulation, as he had promised repeatedly during his campaign. This week, the president also changed course on NATO after he previously threatened to dissolve the alliance.
The Secretary General and I had a productive discussion about what more NATO can do in the fight against terrorism. I complained about that a long time ago, and they made a change. And now they do fight terrorism. I said it was obsolete. It's no longer obsolete.
S.V. Dante joins us now. He's senior White House correspondent with The Huffington Post. S.V., welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be back.
Well, this has been an eventful week as far as the president's policy moves go. What big changes have we seen in his stances?
What changes haven't we seen in his stances? Probably is easier. It was amazing. He did an interview with Fox Business, which was very interesting, and he talked about the meeting that he had with the Chinese president in Mar-a-Lago and talking about the weapons strikes and the missile strikes. And then he had an interview with the Wall Street Journal in which he kind of went back on half a dozen major policy platforms that he positions that he had during the campaign. As you mentioned, among them, Vladimir Putin, NATO, currency manipulation, whether China was guilty of that or not, interest rates, whether they're too low or too high. In the campaign, of course, he'd claimed that they'd been artificially kept low for the purpose of helping President Obama all those years. Whether he would keep Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve, the Export-Import Bank, and whether that was a good thing or not. In the campaign, he said it was a bad thing and he'd get rid of it. Now he's come around to decide that, no, actually, it's a very good thing and he should keep it. So it's kind of kind of whiplash-inducing, I guess. And will it last? I don't know. I mean, he changed his mind relatively quickly on these things, it seems. Just earlier this month, he had said that he called China like a master manipulator of currency, and then in yesterday's Wall Street Journal interview, they're not manipulating currency. So who knows? Maybe he'll change his mind the other way and go back to his original positions.
Well, the president has said to be successful, you have to be flexible. So is that what we're seeing here? Flexibility, a new president in office who's learning as he goes along?
Well, learning, sure. I think some of that is based on he had these opinions during the campaign without a whole lot of knowledge. If you paid attention to his interviews, when he was asked policy details about the things that he believed, he really didn't have any. He would make these assertions, but was kind of unable to back them up with facts. So maybe now he's actually learning some facts and modifying his positions to match them, I suppose. I guess that's possible. The other possibility is that with the loss of importance of Steve Bannon, we're seeing other people's ideas, like Gary Cohn, formerly of Goldman Sachs, who's his chief economic advisor, Jared Kushner, who's his son-in-law and also a senior White House aide. Maybe those folks are having more of an influence on what the president is thinking now than Steve Bannon used to.
Do you think it represents a turn or a pivot, as some people are calling it, toward maybe more orthodox views than he seemed to hold on the campaign trail?
At least so far, that's absolutely what we're seeing. I mean, not calling China a currency manipulator has been the position of the United States for years, because, in fact, they've moved their currency in the other direction over the past couple of years. Interest rates being too high or too low, what was the reason that was done? Janet Yellen has been seen as a pretty competent Fed chair. NATO has seen as important for almost 70 years. So in a way, yeah, he's getting back to what most American politicians have believed for a very long time.
And new presidents, they often struggle with promises that they make on the campaign trail. President Obama was unable to close Guantanamo. George W. Bush struggled with the deficit. Is that what we're seeing with President Bush, or Trump, rather? Is it any different?
It is somewhat different, because closing Guantanamo was maybe not the majority view, but it was a view of a sizable number of people in this country, and it was considered policy that there was a downside to keeping it open. Some of Donald Trump's views during the campaign were not really based on evidence of the actual world, it seems. And, for example, some of his views on trade and whether particular trade agreements were good or bad. So maybe now, for the first time, we're seeing some sort of evidence-based analysis enter into his statements about these things, which is a little bit different from what I think both President George W. Bush and certainly President Obama had done in their time.
Right now, we are talking with S.V. Date, senior White House correspondent at the Huffington Post, looking at President Trump reversing himself on several key positions this week, and looking at why some voters may have chosen to go with Donald Trump in the election. Are these position changes, do you think, going to have any reverberations with that group of people who have supported him in the past?
It may. Among those who really do believe that the U.S. needs to get out of world affairs and kind of isolate and just think about ourselves, yeah, it may. But I've got to tell you that a lot of people who supported Donald Trump did so because he promised them they would get their high-paying job back, which they had maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and no one else was making that promise, so what did they have to lose? Now, if he can't do that, and the laws of economics suggest that he can't in many cases, that's, I think, when you'll start to see a lot of that support in the upper Midwest start to disappear on him.
And looking more closely at some of these changes that happened over the past 6 days or so, President Trump reversed, as you said, his much more critical stance on China and said that China was not manipulating currency. Can you talk us through a little bit how that change unfolded? What happened?
Well, if I knew, I would be able to tell you, but it seemed to happen merely by having conversations with Chinese President Xi Jinping. He, as you know, the Chinese president was at Mar-a-Lago, which is a President Trump's resort that he owns in Palm Beach last weekend. And between the time he spent with them there and then between a subsequent phone call they had earlier this week for about an hour, I guess, President Trump came around to agree with a lot of the views that President Xi had been explaining, including, for example, Donald Trump had been convinced that if China wanted change in North Korea, it could happen instantly almost. And all that needed to happen to affect the situation in North Korea was to have China on board. Well, now he says, well, you know, it's actually kind of complicated because China and Korea, they have a long history going back many years, thousands of years. And so maybe this isn't so easy after all. So it was obviously those discussions that got him to this new position. I don't know, again, how long that will last. President Trump seems to have a tendency to accept whatever the last person told him was. And at this moment, maybe that's because that was President Xi.
And Sharish, I want to talk about NATO. President Trump, again, previously threatened to dissolve NATO. Maybe he said it wouldn't be such a bad thing if NATO didn't exist, that they weren't fighting terrorism. And now he is behind NATO as of recently. What does a switch like that do in terms of the relationship the United States has with its allies in NATO?
Right. Well, in terms of that, in terms of those relationships, it helps them immensely because, I'll tell you, I've spoken to some folks in Germany and in Great Britain, and they were more than a little nervous about having the United States president say things like, maybe if you don't pay up, maybe we can do without NATO, maybe it's obsolete, maybe it's past its time, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not exactly sure how he gets his mind around this, but basically what he's saying is this. They have acceded to my demands. They have done what I told them that they had to do. And so NATO is now just fine. And those two things that he speaks about are they're going to have their members all contribute 2% of their GDP, and they're going to focus on terrorism. Now, the thing about increasing their support, the financial support, in terms of building up their own militaries now, there's no direct payments from one country to another. That happened in 2014. So that's been in works now for 2.5 years. And in terms of not fighting terrorism, well, the one and only time that NATO has invoked its common defense language has been when they supported the United States following the terrorist attacks on 9/11, 2001. So on both counts, he's factually wrong. But yet he's decided that because he's learned about these things, I guess, they're actually doing those things that he said they should do, and therefore all is good. I mean, the statement yesterday that they used to be obsolete, now they're no longer obsolete, was pretty amazing hearing that.
Well, and just briefly, Sharish, you said that this is something allies in NATO would welcome hearing, but on the other hand, this is also, in a word, it's unpredictable. And does that very unpredictability have a cost, too, even though at this time, in this case, this is something that maybe members of NATO are eager to hear?
Right. They are eager to hear it. They are still nervous that a mind that could be changed so quickly in one direction can possibly change back in the other. On the other hand, this is better than where they were 3 weeks ago, right? So that's a step in the right direction. And perhaps more important, we have a change in the National Security Council now. I mean, whereas Steve Bannon had been a member of that and was run by Mike Flynn, and Mike Flynn was right behind Trump the entire way during the campaign, and maybe that was allowing the president's views on NATO to color his own. Now we have a General H.R. McMaster, who's a career Army officer who is not a supporter of Trump before accepting this job. And so we have a very different type of leadership and staffing at the National Security Council than we did just a few weeks ago. And maybe that's what's behind some of these changes, because now that's a person who is speaking to President Trump daily. And maybe he's influencing his ideas on what is and is not important.
We're looking at President Trump reversing himself on several key positions this week. Our guest is SB Date, senior White House correspondent at the Huffington Post. And we want to hear from you on this. You can call us at 800-642-1234. Do you see this as a necessary course correction, or are you disappointed that the president seems to be backing away from some campaign promises? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us email to ideas@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation about President Trump's recent policy reversals, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of his reversals on questions pertaining to NATO, Russia, Syria, and China? Is this the result of the realities of the presidency setting in, or do you see other forces at work? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And SB Date stays with us now. He's a senior White House correspondent at the Huffington Post. And let's take our first caller now. We have Jim on the line in Altoona. Jim, hi.
Hey, hi there. Yeah, I want to make a comment. I think the discussion here needs to be broader. We're talking about this solely as a policy reversal. I see it as a bigger issue. And let me say that in order to understand how President Trump makes decisions or thinks or acts, I think it's necessary for anyone who comments seriously to have read his book, The Art of the Deal. In that book, he stresses that in order to negotiate with anybody, you need leverage. And I believe that's what is the case here. So currency manipulation is the leverage, or one of the leverage points, the primary leverage point, being used with China in order to get them to help us deal with North Korea. That's the bigger issue here. So how does he go to the table and get them to do that? I believe that he did that by using currency manipulation as his leverage point. And if you help us with North Korea, I will back off my position that you're a currency manipulator and not pursue an agenda along those lines that would harm China.
Jim, thank you so much for bringing that up. And yeah, there are those who say if you want to understand what's happening with Donald Trump, read Donald Trump. He explains his thinking in books like The Art of the Deal. Is there something to that, Sharish?
Well, I would be, I guess, more ready to accept that if Donald Trump had actually written The Art of the Deal. As we have heard from his ghostwriter, Donald Trump gave some general ideas about what he would like in it, and then Tony Schwartz wrote the book, and then Donald Trump went through the manuscript and either okayed it or not okayed it, and mostly okayed it, and that was that. So in terms of currency manipulation, as a factual matter, the Chinese currency has been moving in the opposite direction from what you would expect under if they were actually manipulating it to enhance their trade for the last 2 years. So there wasn't really much to give them other than say, okay, fine, you're not actually doing this. Now will you help us with North Korea? I don't know if that's necessarily using leverage or bargaining chips. China has an interest in controlling North Korea. I don't think they want the dictator there, Kim Jong-un, to have nuclear weapons. So we have a natural agreement point, big picture, right there. I don't know if currency manipulation or anything to do with trade really has a lot to do with that.
And do you see the kind of twin strands that Jim was getting at there, sort of a business mindset of leverage and deal-making versus maybe diplomacy, maybe tough diplomacy? Do you see them as having things in common or more things that are different about those two approaches?
Well, I'm not really sure what to say about that. I mean, Donald Trump is really his main business for the last, I would say, 20 years since his casinos failed, has been selling his name. He's been branding his name on buildings all over the country and the world, and that's kind of what his business model has been. Prior to that, his casinos failed, his airline failed. He was forced to the brink of bankruptcy, to give up his yacht, all kinds of things. So if it is a business mindset, I'm not sure it's one that will be helpful in terms of dealing with other countries, because the deals that he made when he was a self-described genius businessman weren't that great. Now, again, no one can run the presidency by himself. It's much too big a job, and the people who are in his ear the most now are very different from the people who were in his ear during the campaign and in the first month or so of the presidency. And I think that's probably better explains what's going on than some sort of deal-making paradigm.
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And I want to take a next call here from Saeed in Green Bay. And by the way, you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Saeed, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I think the analysis of your guest speaker, very much like the analysis of most people on the left, is really driven by a visceral hate for Trump that does not, that interferes with her objectivity. So for me, it resonates very much that we have been very poor negotiators in the last 8 years in the international arena. So, for example, we started the Obama administration started their engagement with the Russians by unilaterally withdrawing the deployment of anti-ballistic missiles in Eastern Europe, as was planned, without getting anything in return. It is the first time in American history that the United States could not even negotiate the terms of its surrender in Syria. Okay, and so yes, we have lost. Our negotiations with Iran are shameful. Okay, the very
and Saeed, I'm going to jump in. I want to make sure we're running short of time, and I want to make sure our guests can answer. Do you want to respond to Saeed's comments so far, Sharish?
Well, I mean, there are facts, and facts kind of matter. I mean, in terms of Russia, I mean, I think the Obama administration will say, yeah, that didn't work out. I think they're the first ones to say that. On the other hand, they did renew and enhance a nuclear arms treaty. So that happened, and that's still the controlling feature between the two countries in terms of nuclear weapons. In terms of the Iran deal, it's interesting that although the President Trump said he's going to rip it up and do away with it and renegotiate it, his own National Security Council team is saying, you know what, it's working. They are not developing nuclear weapons. They've done what they said they would do in terms of getting rid of their nuclear material and not making more. So for that portion of it, I don't think you're going to see any change to that deal because it's actually doing what it's supposed to do. Now, in terms of their ballistic missile technology, that's another matter, but that wasn't part of the nuclear deal.
And Saeed, thank you for that call. And Sharish, we've got about a little more than 30 seconds here. I want to touch on Donald Trump rumored to be on the verge of firing his chief strategist, Steve Bannon. Do we know what's perhaps behind that change of heart?
Well, I don't know if it's him firing him necessarily or whether Steve Bannon if he gets pushed out of serious decision-making loops, is going to say, well, you know, I don't need to be here. I've got other things to do. And maybe it'll be a combination of both. My understanding is that the president was not pleased that Steve Bannon was getting so much credit for the policy initiatives that he did in that first month, for winning the election, for coming up with those speeches and ideas that got him through those final weeks of the campaign. The president likes to think that he's responsible for all his successes, and when other people are given credit, that kind of irks him and rubs him the wrong way. So maybe it's a mishmash of all of these things.
And we leave it there. SV, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was SV Date, senior White House correspondent with the Huffington Post, looking at President Trump's reversals on several key policies this past week.